Hello and welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast. It's Friday Live. I'm Walter Latham, your host, and I'm joined by our co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs. We are also joined by our distinguished panel who brings their knowledge and their life experience to bear on the issues facing Black and Brown people. And also like to wish again, this is my third time, a very happy birthday to our panelist, Judy Andrews.
Thank you so much.
Happy birthday. Hey.
Thank you.
Yes, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. That is so kind. Very kind.
Okay, let's get on with the show. All right. The title of today's show was Did the media purposely ignore the Sum of Soul? And that's incorrect. Sum of Soul is incorrect. Sum of Soul is a documentary that's out now by Questlove that is on Hulu. That's the title of it. But the actual title was the Harlem Festival, Harlem Cultural Festival, which occurred back in 1969. But before we go forward, I just want to know, has anyone heard of Woodstock? What about Shelter by the Rolling Stones that was done around 1969? Y'all guys heard of that, right?
Definitely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But I bet that all of you have not heard about the cultural festival that was run in Harlem in 1969.
Not at all.
That ran for 6 days during the same time frame. And this rivaled Woodstock. But for some reason, the majority of our people have never heard of it. And so what this show would like to know, what we'd like to do is explore why. All right. And try to, you know, do a little deep dive and try to inform people of what happened. And y'all guys can go forth and look at it. I was looking at, it's a festival. It was a concert that ran over 6 days. And they had some great people there. All right. So let's do a deep dive in that. And then I'm going to introduce the panel real quick before we proceed. We have Judy Andrews, a published author and poet and retired New York City school teacher. We have Gene Edwards Jr., male district leader of the 79th district in the Bronx. We have Gregory Coleman, TWW technology lead and owner of Illumination Media. We have Sergeant Ernest J. Robinson, USMC, and motivational speaker. And of course, we have Christopher Sweeney, chef and owner of Johnny Ruth Catering. I'd like to thank the panel. And we want to move on to, I think I'm going to start with Greg. So Greg, since you, this is one of the topics that you put on the docket for us, can you tell us a little bit about this big festival that had hundreds of thousands of people over 6 days?
Sure thing. So the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival was at Mount Morris Park, which is now Marcus Garvey Park in Harlem. And it lasted for 6 weeks. And over that period in the summer was, you know, just some top of the line performing acts, especially in the African-American community. I mean, you had Stevie Wonder, Mahalia Jackson, Nina Simone, The Fifth Dimension, the Staple Singers, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and one of my favorites, Sly and the Family Stone. It was timely in the fact that it was at an integral period in history, really, and in this country. I mean, things had just finished boiling over, or were just starting to boil over with the recent assassinations of Martin Luther King, you know, Robert Kennedy, a few years before Malcolm X, a couple of years before that, John F. Kennedy. So Medgar Evers. So, you know, it was race riots. It was something that the community, the Harlem community really, you know, just jumped on. They enjoyed it. they were, you know, came out in droves. And miraculously, after that 6-week period, even though there was cameras on the scene, it was covered by the television, the mayor of New York, Robert Lindsay, was there. Miraculously, this coverage disappeared. And that coverage sat in the producer's basement for 50 years before it was discovered, a couple of years ago, actually. And then the rest is history. Partnered, the producer, Robert Fivelent, got with Questlove, and it was purchased by Searchlight Pictures and Hulu, and they put it out, you know, over the summer. And I was blown away because I personally didn't remember. And of course, like you said, I remembered Woodstock, love Woodstock, no real, you know, beef with the cult, the coverage Woodstock got, but would have loved to seen this get just as much coverage because it was just as impactful. But, you know, I saw this and loved it. I talked, you know, to some family members later, and they were there all summer. And I was just amazed that I never heard of it. So that's kind of like a synopsis of what we're dealing with here with this, to me, iconic project in history.
Yeah, I know. I watched it, and you know, I'm surprised. You know, I've heard of a lot of different things, and for this, for me to first hear of it when you brought it up during a production meeting, it was like, wow, man, I never heard of that. Then when I watched it, it was just, I was just taken aback by the fact that I've never seen it, right?
Yeah,
and right. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was gonna say it was the same day as the moon landing. While Woodstock was going on. So there were a lot of things going on at that same time. And then during that summer, there were a lot of riots. And a lot of people thought that, you know, maybe, you know, this concert could quell that anger that African-Americans were feeling about the economic disparity, as well as the riots that were going on after the deaths of so many leaders. So that was like July 20th. You had three different events that were going on. People were going to Central Park to watch the moon landing and on these screens. And at the same time, people were headed toward Woodstock for a concert with so many well-known people. But there were also well-known people at Mount Morris Park. And I was only 7. But, you know, as I had never heard of it as I grew up. I never knew this existed until I, you know, watched the film on I believe it was Hulu. And it was unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. I'm even surprised that my parents didn't go see it. I'm shocked that they didn't. They lived in Brooklyn at the time. And they had to have known about it, but I'm surprised. I'd never heard them talk about it. So it is historic, you know, and the same issues that back then in 69 are the same issues today, the disparity, the economic disparity with the poverty rate of among African Americans is just about the same as it was today as in 1969, 9.2%. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do.
Well, as the only person on this panel who was not born during this festival.
You keep rubbing it in,
I take offense to that. I was only one. I was only one, though.
I'm going to cut this out before we push it out to the platform. That's what I'm going to start doing. All right, go ahead.
I'm joking. All right. So,
I should have never said it.
Right. Well, see, that's what I'm saying. Judy started, but I digress. But when I'm looking at it, and when I was doing a little bit of research, it actually started back in 1967. Interesting about the history of Tony Lawrence, who actually came from the same island or same country. St. Kitts and Nevis, that my grandfather actually immigrated from. But when, in as far as your question, as far as like, did the media leave it out? Did our Black leaders leave it out? Like, where was the responsibility to make sure that it was shown? to duplicate it, to, you know, have another festival. You know, because it, whose responsibility is it, really? I think we had, I think we were talking before about the elders who used to tell the stories and pass down the history. You know, so where was the responsibility to those who performed, those who attended, to make sure that it didn't go anywhere? You know, that's just my perspective of it. I mean, I think that the media probably could have done a better job, but I think we could have done a better job of demanding it and making sure that we didn't forget something like this.
Hey, could I chime in there? I learned about this when I was in junior high school, actually. Some years ago, Ernest, I'm not going to go back that far to tell you, but I had a junior high school teacher. I was in a band class, and he actually told us about this. You know, he was very familiar with it. He was one of the people that attended. And he reminded us that the NYPD didn't want to give any security for it. So the Black Panthers actually were some of the people that did security, just like FOI would do that in recent years for concerts held by Black people. And one of the reasons that he said it wasn't publicized was because they didn't want Black people to unite around it. So it was something that they purposely put, you know, kind of pushed to the side and tried not to, because it was an event that went off with very few incidents, and they didn't want that good publicity to get out there. That's what he said, you know, being a person that attended it. So, but he said it was phenomenal just to see his heroes up there. Something great.
All right. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I could see that. I could see why somebody would want to suppress something like that. But then in that same vein, like, I can see why he shared that story with his class. Why the professor shared that story with his class, and why I would think that, again, there would be more leaders to share that, to sit there and say, no, we're not a bunch of whatever derogatory name that you can possibly think of to call us, that we can, you know, congregate together and be harmonious and enjoy life. And, you know, and there can be hundreds, there can be thousands and hundreds of thousands of us in one place over a 6-week period. I mean, something like that, you know, you would think would never happen in today's society. Right. Where, I mean, statistically, when you think about the weekends, you can have 40 people get shot and killed in a weekend. And something like this to take place. So, I mean, so we're forgetting that we are better than what we're being portrayed. But again, sometimes, and again, I always, from time to time, thank Walt for having this platform, because it's our responsibility to tell our stories.
Absolutely. There were prominent African-American leaders there. Jesse Jackson was there. There were a lot of politicians that were there that were part of it. And again, why it wasn't spoken about more, I don't know. And I think part of the reason, again, that it was a volatile time in history, especially for African Americans. There was a lot of riots, a lot of stuff going on. And I think that this was something that could have galvanized people and got people together. And they purposely pushed it down, because it attracted over 300,000 people. It almost got close to the numbers that Woodstock got, you know, but Woodstock was a mess. It was a lot of violence, a lot of craziness going on.
Yeah.
And yet Woodstock was the one that was highlighted more. And again, I think it was just because of the artists that were in this festival were African-American. They didn't want to give them any credit. They didn't want to give them any shine. And, you know, more so, the artists at Woodstock were the artists of the time that got all the credit and got all the notoriety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. You also had Puerto Ricans, Afro-Cubans.
Yes, you did.
So you had a, you know, you had the brown and the black and the
Remember, this was billed as a Harlem cultural event, not necessarily a black American event.
Absolutely.
It was a Harlem culture. So it was about promoting the culture that existed in Harlem. So, you know, Hispanics, Latinos, they rallied around this mm-hmm. festival just like everybody else did, just the residents of Harlem. Mm-hmm. So it was momentous to me in that effect. I think one of the things that negatively affected it also is, you know, I can remember when I first heard people talk about this, the first thing I thought of before they said the name, you remember a cultural festival that took place? I thought it was Wattstax that took place in L.A., mm-hmm. you know, a couple of years later. And I remember how much pub that got. As a matter of fact, I went to see that in the movies when it came out, when it finally hit the theater. But that took place over a weekend. Woodstock took place over a weekend, you know, over a few days. This carried on. This was actually several events. So I don't know if it was easy to say, you know, this big event happened in this weekend, whether it could have been publicized better among the mainstream media. But maybe it's something that, you know, after the first week it was big, but then there was less interest the second week, less interest the third week, less interest after that. But all of that to me is no excuse for something Ernest brought up, is something that we should have promoted ourselves. The Woodstock promoters went out there and promoted the heck out of this. And of course, they had a little bit of an upper hand. People were receptive to that. But you know, it just baffles me how something like this can supposedly sit in somebody's basement for 50 years. That's the story. But, you know, and mm-hmm. the folklore didn't build up in the community. Like you said, there were prominent black leaders there. They should have been talking this up. How come we didn't see it? You know, where's the footage of it? You know, hey, Sly mm-hmm. and the Family Stone was at Woodstock and this in the same summer, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It just... It's
and they performed music that was really uplifting and inspiring. There was, you know, there was no cussing.
Nope.
It was, you know, there were little kids there. There were, you know, kids who were 7 and 8 years old. There was no violence. It was a family event. So it is kind of strange that you didn't hear about this and no one talked about it. And also, there were a lot of other things going on, including the Vietnam War. So it's just shocking to me that this particular concert brought so many cultures together, because there were a few white folks there. It was Harlem. It was a group. It was for the Harlem community. 50 years and no one talks about it. You know, I wonder how people became aware of it. Like, how all of a sudden was it this time to bring that out in 2021?
Well, you know,
I think Questlove was the force behind that.
Right.
And you got artists mm-hmm. now who are in positions that they weren't in before to make decisions and to put their stories out there. They're getting to tell mm-hmm. their stories. And it's unfortunate mm-hmm. that it took 50 years to tell this story, but look how long it's taken us to get into a position to make movies, to dictate what goes mm-hmm. on television. And you have, it's not regular TV. It's on Hulu or Netflix. So these platforms are catering to this kind of, these kind of stories, which is great. They're actually competing for our stories.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
You're absolutely right, Chris. I mean, they're catering to their subscribers, and a significant amount of their subscribers are people of color.
So the official,
So
the official story is.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Well, no, that's okay. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
The official story is that this producer, Robert Fivelin, and another guy, David Dinerstein, were discussing this, and they became aware that the footage was sitting in this basement from this guy, Hal Tolchin, that originally took the footage. And So he passed away in 2017. Before he passed away, the two of those guys got rights to the footage. And Fivelin was an entertainment lawyer from LA, but he grew up in Tampa. They don't really say how he became aware of it, but it was in discussions. Actually, but that's the original footage. What we saw as the documentary Summer of Soul, Questlove put that together. And he, you know, edited the footage and put that together just as a, you know, reintroduction. And you know, that in conjunction with Hulu and I forgot the management company again, Searchlight Pictures, did it for Hulu just as a reintroduction to, you know, bring this to the nation's attention. But again, like I said, that's the story.
Yeah, and I understand that there's, you know, I understand that there's more footage of, it's not just what we just, what we saw on Hulu. There's like thousands of hours.
Let's see. I want to see that 50 hours of footage.
Yeah. Oh, it's 50 hours of thousands and 50 hours of footage. Yeah, so I think that could be a series that, you know, that really could be a series on Hulu. And it's something to see because many of our young people have no idea of how great these people were. These were icons. Of course, they know Stevie Wonder, but they don't know Nina Simone. And I had to, I know when I was teaching, I actually brought music into my class of Nina Simone, and they were shocked. They loved her style. They loved, you know, of course, you know, she cusses in one particular song. They loved that part. But they understood why she was cussing. We had a whole lesson around it. There was, and then what was really fascinating about this particular film is that I thought that she was going to start some trouble because at the end of the film, she sings and she's telling people, she wasn't saying, are you angry? But she would say, are you ready? Are you, do you want to, you know, fight? Do you want to continue the struggle? And I thought she's going to start some trouble. I really thought that was going to happen. But they loved her and they respected her. And what she did was awaken people to open their eyes about what was going on that would make them feel bad about themselves. She wanted to uplift them and make them feel, you know, you are beautiful, you are gifted, you know, you have so many opportunities in life. You don't have to take what they're giving you. It was a really motivating and inspiring film for young people to see, and for people who felt that they were down on their luck and there was just nothing to live for. You know, my favorite part was when the guy from The Temptations, David Ruffin.
Oh yeah, David Ruffin
came out to sing. I was screaming in my living room, like, "Oh my, this is the real one, the real one!" You know, I saw The Temptations on, or you know, the play of the "Proud Ain't Too Proud," but he had such an astonishing voice, even after the things with drugs and the life that he had. His voice never failed. He had such an uplifting voice. And then there are the Staples Singers that the kids don't know about, the Staples Singers. You know, they only hear them in the rap songs, you know, that made music with their music. There were so many great performers, you know. So I think that they need to do a series and bring the rest of that footage. You know, because it really is fascinating to see. I was, and Gladys Knight and the Pips, when she was like, she wasn't a teenager, but she was maybe in her 20s then.
You know, and what? You know what? I'm
sorry. It was amazing.
I'm sorry to jump in there, Judy, but
yes,
we should have had Hulu sponsor this show, you know, because instead you got to go to Hulu.
Yeah, I mean? That's right. That's right.
So, we should have had them sponsor this show. Next time.
Yes.
Next time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so, I want to ask this question, though. Although I'm excited about all of this information coming out and all of these shows and that they're really uncovering and, you know, trying to, you know, give a nod to the people that they ignored for years, so much of it is still not owned by us. So for me, it's a double-edged sword, right? We're getting to see these acts.
But why is somebody else always behind telling our story? Mm-hmm. They own the rights to it. They own the rights. All of a sudden, the guy dies and somebody else, not from the community, owns this stuff, owns the right rights to this. You got an album by Prince getting ready to drop. I think it drops today, and we're finding out that his family sold 50% of his catalog to this gigantic company that owns everybody's catalog. It's just so much that, you know, for me, Hulu, Netflix, it almost feels like, you know, on the heels of BLM, everybody sees an opportunity to make money off of us.
Yeah, and the same thing with BET, Essence Magazine, Essence Communications, you know, Time Magazine, you know, bought into different African-American major organizations. And now they own it, even down to the hair organizations, you know, people who like Lisa, I forgot her name, that does the natural hair products, you know, she sold it to, you know, Revlon. So, or L'Oreal, she sold it to. So, you know, we have so many issues with this of other people owning things that we had first.
I think it's
so
something
we have to learn how to keep it, forget the money and keep it to ourselves.
That's right, yeah. Judy and Chris. I think it's something we got to be so aware of. I think all these, you know, conglomerates are understanding just how profitable it is becoming to co-opt our movements, and they're successful at it. And Chris, that it is concerning. I think it's turning just a slight bit in the fact that you have more Black companies that are able to tell our story. But it was, you know, and in the 60s, that wasn't possible, you know, and it's a shame.
That's right.
It's a shame it wasn't possible.
They invested for years and years and years in telling a story about Harlem that was filled with drugs, pimps, and all kinds of things. And
oh, yeah.
Yes, that was Harlem, but that wasn't all of Harlem. It wasn't the entire story. And they purposely told those stories, you know, the Nicky Bond stories, all of those stories can get told over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But this concert series that was a gem, that was something that was great. And it was uplifting people at a time where they needed something different. They needed to, to breathe and relax a little bit. Because we would, you know, besieged with the war and the killings of Martin and all the riots and all the drugs that they were surrounded by. And here you had this moment in time where everything stood still and they just enjoyed themselves. And that story couldn't get told soon enough. I'm glad it's being told now. Amen. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
I want it to be told. But there's a lot of stories like this.
Yes, there are.
The last 50 years.
We haven't even scratched the surface on this.
Yes,
drip, all of a sudden, you're going to see a flood of information that comes out.
And that's what makes me nervous about it, that they're profiting at this very time when we're a little bit of, you know, we're in an uproar and George Floyd and BLM. Let's profit off of them. We can make some money off of this right now.
Yeah, and it's happening in publishing, too. There's a group that I'm in, and this you know, woman who is not of color, got together and she wants, you know, as many African-American stories as she can find because she wants to make a profit from it. She wants to be able to represent us. she represents us, you know, she's going to get paid and we're going to get paid too. So you have to be extremely careful not to give your work away. Yes.
No.
Yeah, Judy, is she a person of color? Yes, no?
No.
No, no. She's a white woman who wants to build up her resume by getting Black authors and authors of color, you know, Hispanic, you know, I'll just say authors of color as well as African Americans.
Well, I mean, you can't. She's an entrepreneur, so she sees an opportunity. I'm not mad at her, but
she sees an opportunity.
She's filling a need there.
The need. But, that's right.
Right. She's filling a need.
So you have to hold on to your work as well. You know, you can share, but make sure that you own it. So as long as you own it, you know, hey, you could look at it, you know, if you're going to make some money, but it's my work and I want to make sure that I'm making more than you. But we can't just give our stuff away. We can't.
Yeah, I have to go back to what Chris is saying and what Greg was saying, and Ernest, you know, just to try to cover that under one umbrella is the fact that ownership, you know, the rights too.
That's right.
Know, having the rights to the content. You own the content. You can rent out. You can lease it out. I mean, you know, you can whatever and take your commission, but you retain. The retention of the rights is most important.
That's right. That's right. You must own your copyright.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's what I mean. I think I first heard this in a discussion with Michael Jackson's catalog to his work. All right. And it may have been some other instances or events that were catalogs, the ownership. I think it had to do with music, with the publishing rights, the, you know, that type of thing.
And trademarks.
But that came up. And trademarks, of course.
Yes.
But we have to retain that. But, you know, people are greedy. Everybody has a price. So I can't put myself in a person's place and say, okay, somebody comes and offers me $50 million for something that I got sitting in the basement. And say, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to take this $50 million. Just let it sit down there until I can find somebody where and I can do it in such a way that I retain the rights. That's a hard thing because everybody has a price.
What's disappointing for me, especially with Prince, is that he fought so hard to win his masters back, to win control over his catalog. And he did it. And you know, people thought he was crazy for many years. He scribbled slave on his name and, you know, he changed his name to that symbol. And everybody thought he was crazy, right? But he did it and he won. He beat the industry. And for his family to sell half of that is really disappointing because he worked so hard. And he was such an artist where he always, he wouldn't work with other, like the young rappers, he would tell them, I'm not going to do a record with you unless you own your masters. He was trying to push them in that direction because he knew what he went through. So again, it's disappointing to see that he fought that hard fight and won, and then he passes away and his family sells 50% of his estate.
Yep. Well, you can also apply that to the land that you know, some of our ancestors owned that was passed down to us. And we sold it because, you know, you may have 100 different descendants. And all you need is one, you know, to upset that apple cart for that property to be sold. So that it applies more than just that. It applies to assets in general that is passed down. Yes.
Hey,
Walter. Gene.
I would like to talk about that era from a political standpoint. Harlem was excited. Harlem was full of pride because a year prior to that concert series in Marcus Garvey Park, Harlem reinstated Adam Clayton Powell Jr. to Congress. Remember, he got kicked out of Congress, and what the Democratic Party did was they kept his name off of the ballot. So on the ballot where it says write-in name,
right,
tens of thousands of people in Harlem went to the polls and wrote in his name. And that's how Adam Clayton Powell won victory and was reinstated into the United States House of Representatives. So Harlem was on fire with pride. It's like, y'all try to, you know, rid us of our crown prince. And we put him back in. And his name wasn't even on the ballot. You know, so there were big things going on in Harlem. There was a lot of pride going on around that time. I just wanted to add that little known truth.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Jane. Thank you. I didn't even know. I was still in North Carolina during that time. I was still in school. But I do definitely remember Adam Clayton Powell. Yeah, he was a hero of mine. So, let's just try to stay on topic a little bit and then talk more about this Harlem Cultural Festival. You know, I got the, you know, looking at the documentary on Hulu, and that's where y'all guys can find it now. But if you wait long enough, it's going to be out there free somewhere, hopefully on YouTube or something like that. But, you know, just to look at the people in the audience, the way they were dressed, you had the afros, the dashikis, the bell bottoms. There was a lot of pride that was shown out there. And people were, it seemed to me, and this is my impression, when you look at it, you may get a different impression, all right, that they were looking to be galvanized. They were looking, you know, to get away from that day-to-day suppression, mm-hmm. you know, that they were going through. But, and this event represented happiness to them, a way yes. for them to be happy. What do y'all guys think about that?
I agree fully. That's why I think
yes, I agree.
They mm-hmm. purposely didn't, the media didn't have eyes on it the way they should have, because it was going to galvanize people. And they did have yes. a lot of pride. I watched it too. And I saw, mm-hmm. and what did J. Edgar Hoover say? The most dangerous thing in this country would be black people uniting. So they didn't want to see that happen.
I think that
exactly.
it was.
And I was surprised to find out too, and I'm with Ernest, I'll turn right back over to you. I was surprised that, you know, a lot of the acts, they wanted security. You know, of course you want security. All right. So they turned to the NYPD and they said, no, we're not going to be securing anything. So the first day, guess who provided security for the event, day one? The Black Panthers. Now I was surprised, but then the NYPD, the second day, NYPD probably said to themselves, "Oh no, we can't have this. This is our turf." So then they took over security. But the Black Panthers provided security day one. Yeah. So Ernest.
Yeah. No. What I was gonna say was, you know, in accordance with what you were saying about, you know, everyone wanting to be galvanized, the pride that they had. Because of 1969, because of what Gene had, you know, informed us about Adam Clayton Powell being reinstated, you had in Chicago, you had Fred Hampton, who was assassinated, and all the assassinations that happened in 1968 with Kennedy, Dr. King. You had a bunch of people who were looking for marching orders, mm-hmm. who were looking for a confirmation, you know, saying for what they still believed in. That, you know, as Judy had, you know, alluded to about Nina Simone still saying, are you still ready? Are you still ready for the fight? Are you still ready to struggle? Because we're not done yet. And so they mm-hmm. came there with that pride, with the mindset that yes, we're going to take this break. We're going to grieve. We're going to celebrate. But we're going to move forward. The thing that I find to be disappointing is that never continued.
Right.
When we talk about it in comparison to Woodstock, Woodstock went all the way through 94 with all their troubles that they had, even up to 1999, when they celebrated 25 years of Woodstock. Hmm. And even to, they were going to do a 50th in 2019, but it got canceled because of all of this stuff that's been happening, you know, at Woodstock. But why did we not? So what I would like to see is not just the ownership of music and our rights and stuff like that. I would like for us to be able to get back to a point where we can congregate together with that same type of mindset, mindfulness of that, you know, we want to have pride about what we're doing. We're going to galvanize together. We're going to be organized in what we do and have a mission. But as of right now, I'm not seeing the type of leadership within our music industry. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing that same type of leadership within our political realm. You know, there's some few here and there, and I think that, you know, there's some things that have been organizing us. I'm not saying it's non-existent, but I think that we can do better so we can definitely move forward a lot stronger.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, that's the Walt Weekly's mandate. You know, that's part of our mission, is to call out these things and bring them to people's attention. And I think that's why we exist. That's the value that we bring. You know, is just to keep people focused on the things that, you know, are of concern to us, that are threats to us, and also opportunities to us too, because we work both sides of the table. So, you know, that's our platform. That's our mission, folks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, can we walk back a little bit on the police not stepping up to do the security?
Yeah.
So you don't, because there's a bigger picture with that, right? They refuse to do the security for the event, right? So that tells me that they wanted chaos to ensue because they didn't want the event to be successful. Right. And then the Black Panthers step in to do the security, right? And it goes off the first day with no hitch, right? So you paint the Black Panthers as this militant, violent group. So now the NYPD, you can't have the Black Panthers doing the security and things going well because it goes totally against what you say about them. So now you got to come in and we got to take over now. We'll do the security now. Because they didn't want the Black Panthers to have that good publicity or to look like they were anything other than thugs and violent militants. That's all I wanted to say on that.
I agree. No, I would draw the same conclusions, Chris, definitely, because it went without, the first day went without a hitch, and they weren't even participating. So, you know, as I indicated earlier, you know, you had the Black Panthers moving into their territory, providing something that they should be doing. And doing it well. And there was no violence. If there was, it was so minimal, it was so small that nobody knew about it. But you know one thing? I had totally forgotten about the mayor, John Lindsay.
He
was a Republican. Yes. And he was involved with this. I mean, the guy, I was shocked to find out that he was a Republican.
And he was not afraid to be a part of the crowd. He was not afraid to talk about the people in the crowd and what was happening in the world at the time that affected Black people. He was not afraid. You know, he walked through the streets of Harlem as if he lived there. You know, I was surprised by that because I had heard, you know, growing up, I had heard terrible things about him. But in that film, he seemed to be, I wouldn't say a hero, but he seemed to be someone who supported the empowerment of African-American people, you know, and they actually were able to be very free with him, you know, talking about the issues that affected them. They were, the reporters would interview him along with other African-Americans. And one thing was that they didn't think that people needed to be on the moon when there was so much poverty going on and so much economic strife and disparity going on at that time. Why are people on the moon? And of course, today we have billionaires who have gone to the moon, you know, Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. He's a trillionaire, the richest man in the world, actually. And this is a pandemic. But yet he decided to create this company called Blue Origin to go to the moon. And then around 1970, you know, we had Gil Scott-Heron who wrote a poem about white people being on the moon, you know, as a metaphor for the government going to the moon while people on Earth were starving. So we have this dichotomy of horror going on in the African-American community where people were looking to be uplifted and led. And then you have the issue of, you know, Mayor Lindsay just coming up and saying, well, you know, I agree with you and we have to do something about it. And I was curious to know, where were our leaders at that time? There were so many that were killed during the 60s, that were assassinated during the 60s. Something happened in the 70s, and I think it was a historic significance that kept African-Americans from achieving a lot of the things that we wanted to achieve. One thing we did achieve was affirmative action due to the Civil Rights Acts and the Civil Rights Laws of the late 60s. You know, we were able to, quote unquote, move on up. But something happened in the media as well as the music industry that for some reason would not let African-Americans thrive. And it got worse during the crack epidemic. So each time African-Americans were able to do something positive for themselves, they were torn down by some kind of economic strife, you know. And unfortunately today we have a pandemic. So we need to maybe investigate how that happens. Each time we pull ourselves up, there's something that comes to knock us down. Well, and it's happened throughout history,
right?
And especially in the music industry.
Well, not specifically the music industry. It happened after during Reconstruction when we had
exactly
right and Charleston and, mm-hmm. and places similar. You know mm-hmm. that you know we were doing good, then something happens, and they put an interstate in there, or they come and burn it down, mm-hmm. or find a way to undermine it. Because right. that, you know that is what's going on, and that also applies to the music industry and things of that nature. So yes. You're right.
I think even more specific. I mean, something happened in the late 50s, and it was strategized by the powers mm-hmm. that be. The strategy mm-hmm. was that look, they're getting too strong, they're getting too powerful, yeah. and they're starting to unite. So
that's happening now.
COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, COINTELPRO, CIA, the powers mm-hmm. that be made a concerted effort, number one, to infiltrate any movement that they disagreed with and bring it down from the inside. So we saw right. that with the Panthers. We saw that with the Nation of Islam. We saw that with mm-hmm. the Southern Christian leadership,
uh-huh. group, yeah.
Martin Luther, yeah. the civil rights movement as a whole, and
all the way as far back as Andrew Jackson.
Yes. You know? So the plan. So think so, after years, by the time 1968, 65, 66, 68 came along, it's getting even. Their plan
Andrew
is
Johnson.
Working even mm-hmm. more. It's mm-hmm. even more. They've already destroyed all of these black movements, breaking up movements mm-hmm. and direction. And now we gotta infiltrate these areas with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. so now, yeah, again, you know, it's that old adage, we don't have poppy farms anywhere. Why are mm-hmm. they just coming in our neighborhoods? So
and
we
now
don't
it's
destroy
gun violence.
Those neighborhoods from the inside.
Yeah, we don't
so
make
now,
guns either, right?
So
right.
that was the mm-hmm. effort. That so, you know, by 69, we didn't have anything almost to look through. People were standing there mm-hmm. wondering why. What do we do next? Mm-hmm. And we faced three or four generations of mm-hmm. the after effect. You know, so that was the
yeah,
plan.
Yeah, Greg,
that was Greg, you know, yeah. people like to say, you know, conspiracy theory. That was actually what took place.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I was getting ready
it
to
went as far
that
back
out,
as
Greg.
Andrew
we
Johnson.
Keep,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, go
we
ahead.
Keep saying where were mm-hmm. our absolutely. Black leaders at that time mm-hmm. that attended this event, they were taking them out.
Yeah.
You know, they were silencing them. So that's why, yep. you know, you weren't yep. hearing about it from the people that were, you know, leading us at the time. They were systematically wiping them out.
Mm-hmm. We want to make sure nobody stands up and wants to be a black leader.
Exactly. They were they were dismantling the Panthers. They, mm-hmm. they, you know, Fred Hampton was killed. Martin was killed, mm-hmm. you know.
Assassinated.
So even, right, yeah, right. They were assassinated, right? So
right.
who was going to step up and be a voice at that time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though you're looking for that, but they were just taking them out left and right, systematically wiping them out.
Absolutely. The thing is, guys, is that it's going on right now in front of your very eyes. It's
yes.
happening
yes, it
right
is.
Now.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
When you can read that they did this survey and 47% of Republicans think that they should overturn this election if they mm-hmm. can't do it legally. They have to take matters into their own hands.
Mm-hmm.
All right. When you read stuff like that, I mean, suppose that was coming from us. You know, I hate to go off track, but I think it's relevant. Mm-hmm. All right.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely
it's
relevant.
No, I think it's on track. I think it's on track if the question was, why was this ignored?
That's it. It all rolls into one big ball.
Exactly. Exactly. I think it's dead on.
Yeah. All right, guys. So, Gene, I haven't heard from you in a while. Gene.
I'm just really listening, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. But you always come back and circle back with these words, these gold nuggets of wisdom.
Oh, thank you.
Let them listen.
Thank you. I'm just, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I was born in 1970, So, you know, I'm not trying to offend nobody, but, you know, not y'all...
That's two shots. Now that's Ernest and Gene. That's two shots.
The real truth and nothing but the truth. Okay.
Hey, Walt, that's two people taking shots at us here, Walt.
Yeah, in 1970. Come on. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Chris, you was one. You just said you was one.
Yeah, but I was around.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
Born in 63, right, you know, this stuff is... Right?
Yeah.
I was around. I was in elementary school though. But you know,
Yes.
But anyway, guys, you know, I don't want to jump off topic like that. But as I said, and as Greg indicated, it's all in one big ball. And you know, music is important to us, right? Not to go back off track again. Because, you know, we have to rest, we have to listen, we have to get some type of motivation, and then we get a lot of it we get from music. Mm-hmm. And for them to suppress this for so long, it's just...
I think that what you're saying about music and politics and why this was covered up for so long, I mean, again, there's nothing when we're talking about this and our people in this country that is off topic. There were so many messages that were inside of music. Again, we go back to the elders. When we were in the slave fields, we used to sing songs that gave entire stories, that gave directions, that gave hope and inspiration that no one else really listened to or paid attention to. And so those are some of the most powerful things that we can do. And yourself being a trumpeter and playing, you know, playing in the band, Chris playing in the band, and, you know, many of us all playing instruments of our choice. It's something so powerful about music. And when you have individuals who can use music and messaging and have the largest stage and have hundreds of thousands of individuals to be able to relay that message and then to repeat that message, that is dynamic and powerful. Yes. And so absolutely they'll do everything to suppress it. However, why would we be complicit to allow for it to continue to happen?
Right.
And not push for another opportunity to create another festival, to create another opportunity to continue to get that messaging, because you can see over time, as music continued to develop, that message got less and less and less. Mm-hmm. So now you can count on your hands, on probably one hand, of the quote unquote conscious rappers and R&B singers who sing about love and respect and the dynamics of a family, that, or in the number of, and count on your hands the number of leaders who are truthfully, genuinely out there leading people, you know, saying in the right direction and making things happen. Again, we haven't had a bill for African American people since 1968. The Fair Housing Act was the last bill that was written with African Americans at the forefront of that. Now, granted, a lot of people, you know, benefited from it, but it was from our efforts that happened. They killed our leaders off. 1969, give you one last show, you know, and everybody, and then darkness from there.
Right.
Okay. That's why that point you make right there, Ernest, is why we need to make Biden pay.
Yeah.
The point he just made is the reason why we need to make sure the Biden administration gives us something, because we put him in office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I but think no, well,
wait. So Chris, you're right, but to an extent, what has to happen is we as a people have to give him something to do. We have to give him.
I agree with you.
I'm with you.
We put him in place. Now we have to have our ask. What do we want? And it's got to be given.
Right.
But again, we have to do the legwork. See, the thing about it is that, you know, the Civil Rights Act, Voter Rights Act, Fair Housing Act, all those things were years and years in the making, right? And many of us
again, and I'm not saying that anybody on this call that has to have that type of knowledge, but many people that are even listening don't have the knowledge of how to draft the bill and to get it to your member of Congress and then to go advocate for it, lobby for it day in and day out, year after year, to being able to make sure that you can get and they continue to vote during the midterms, like Walt alluded to, and during the primaries and during the generals and during the special elections, and continue to champion issues until they actually change.
Yeah,
it typically won't now take that many years as it used to take before, because we've seen a lot of changes happen real quickly for many other different communities. But we have to really mean something and really mean what we say. Say what we mean and mean what we say and stick to it and stick by it without any bend and out breaking.
Yeah, the struggle must continue. It's going to continue because we're still so far behind. You know, we're still trying to catch up, but we have to work just as hard. We have to work harder than we've ever worked before so that we don't go back in time, go back into history.
I agree with that, but I have to go back. You know, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I'm sorry if some people didn't hear this, but there was a comment made or an opinion that one reason that we're so far behind and we can't get a grip, a grasp, and you know, and get back up is because we don't have a father, meaning a black leader, one person mm-hmm. that we can rally around and that can lead us, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, the commander, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we need to wait around for someone to come around and lead us.
No.
I think every individual
no one's coming
should
to save
take
us,
their own
right?
lead. And do what they have mm-hmm. to do within their means and wherever we can come together. Mm-hmm. But that central command structure, for lack of a better term, Ernest, you could probably, you know, explain that better. That command and control structure that I think when they said we need a father. And that's why we can't move forward. I don't think that's what hurts us though. Right? It becomes great. But I don't think we can afford to sit back and wait for that. We all have to have our orders. And wherever we can communicate, whether we do it on platforms like this, whether we do it in our churches, whether we do it wherever we can congregate and come together so that we can all coalesce around one, identify with one objective or the multiple objectives to get us to where we need to be, then mm-hmm. we have to do it independently and individually.
But I got a question. That didn't work having right. that
any,
one
any
leader.
Comments on that?
Yeah. Because, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Ernest?
So who's supposed to crown this father as the leader? That's my question.
Walt was saying that we don't need one. We don't need to wait on one. Let Chris say what he had to say, because I definitely heard what he had to
say. Yeah.
Right. I was saying that having one leader,
Chris,
is to
you're
our detriment.
And I can't hear
definitely,
you.
Chris.
It doesn't work.
Definitely.
It gives them a person to target.
Judy, can you
and
hear
take
them?
Us out? Walt, you yes. deserving the show, man. We
and
can
I
can.
You know, I think that the leaders that we do have to come together. And I don't think we don't need to have one person, because they will target him. They target anyone who is doing something unique and special for the African American community. You saw that with Hoover, you know, we saw that with COINTELPRO. We saw that with God help him, God bless him, Al Sharpton. We saw that with Jesse Jackson. Anyone who's trying to do a good deed for the African American community gets watched excessively. So what? They're gonna watch us. We have to just, I guess, be willing to put our lives on the line. And not too many people are willing to do that now, because technology and the types of employment opportunities, the types of money that can be made today is taking precedence. And you have to decide, am I going to take care of my family, or am I going to be on the front lines getting pepper sprayed? Which one am I going to do today? And, you know, it's a very difficult and personal decision to make, because you have to really be revolutionary to create change. And not many people are willing today to be revolutionary, but we can have meetings and we can have conferences and talk and do all of that. But if we're not willing to risk our lives, then the revolution, you know, may not continue.
These are terms that have been coined after years.
But I feel that we have to come together. There's no one person that's going to save us. We have to get together and we have to decide how we are going to save ourselves and each other.
Go ahead
and we have to take risks and sacrifices.
Yeah, we can hear you, but you got to be able to hear us. So hold on one second. So the thing is that we never had one leader. We always had multiple leaders. And the other thing that's different about what happened since Booker T and Marcus Garvey and into the Mega Evers and everything, they were not trying to be revolutionary.
That's right.
They were doing what was right.
What's happening
today, people are trying to become revolutionary. They're trying to be messiahs. They're trying to be a king, an ex, a somebody else worth because me versus just being genuine. When you see something that needs to be picked up, you pick it up. People are doing it now because they're under the scope and the eyes of everyone. And that's part of the reason why it doesn't actually hold water. The reason why people don't have the endurance that people had before, because you actually needed that. Mm-hmm. People, there's a saying in business that you remain hungry, never thirsty. And when you talk about people who are thirsty, they do anything.
A
lot of people right now are just doing whatever it takes to get likes, to get shares, to go viral. And that undermines what the civil rights movement was all about. We can have multiple leaders. We never had one. What was happening though is that the leaders that we did have were starting to see eye to eye. We're starting to have an understanding that we may be coming from different directions. Or from different places, but we're going the same direction. And so when X wanted to partner and get together with Dr. King, Hoover's like, nope, that's a no-go. Robert Kennedy was always giving them problems, you know what I'm saying, when he was the attorney general and then now he want to run for president. Nope, he got to go. You know, Black Panther Party did things that were, again, that just needed to be done. We need schools for our kids. Let them go to school. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to eat in the morning. Make sure we have a food program.
A breakfast program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a breakfast program. They need books. Give them books. They need protection from going just to get from their house to the school. Let's protect them. They did it because it needed to be done. We have to be able to sit there and identify in our communities. What can we do within our communities, within our own capacity, and then let that take fire and lead by example versus by whatever it is that you have to say.
Right. I agree with you. And I believe that is happening. It's happening in small measures for people like Gene.
It's happening in the South Bronx. I'm listening to everything.
Early. Yes, I agree with you. And that's why I used your name.
I haven't said anything. I've just been listening. And one of the things that I've done to keep from getting attacked, instead of making it about me, the district leader, I'm hiding behind my Democratic club. You see everything I'm doing on Facebook that I post. It's always the Estella B. Diggs Democratic Club. First of all, the name in and of itself, Estella B. Diggs, rings bells because she was the first Black woman elected out of the Bronx. And while she was in the New York State Legislature, she was the author of the Women, Infant, and Children's Program. She designer of the WIC program.
The WIC program.
Right. So if anybody tries to attack me, they're really attacking the ghost because Estella been dead for about 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And everything that I do is under the guise of the club. So I empower my president of the club, the vice president, the secretary treasurer, sergeant at arms. I got everybody involved. I brought in a bunch of community activists from around the district. And right now it's an amalgamation of many different people. So no one could point to anybody in particular, but if somebody's going to take the blame, it'd be me as district leader. But as far as the successes in the South Bronx, it's an amalgamation of many people.
Right, I agree, and I think that is how things are going to get done, by many people doing similar things that you are doing in your community.
We're running up against the clock. We're way over the clock now, and I think one of the common themes here, I think, is one leader, two leader, three leaders is not going to get it done. We all have to lead. The mandate is on us to lead individually in our communities and every place we're at. So we're going to wrap this up. I definitely want to thank, you know, all of our panelists. I want to thank Judy, Gene, Chris, Ernest, and we definitely got to thank Walt, and we definitely want to thank Michelle. We miss you. We hope you come on in next week. You can catch the rebroadcast of this on Sunday and look for the YouTube version of it on Monday. So that's Sunday for the rebroadcast and the YouTube version of this on Monday. Hope y'all all have a great week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be at you next week with another powerful topic.
Thank you.
Great job, Greg.